All right, welcome everyone. It's Sunday afternoon. This is Cancel the Cabal, and I'm Stephen Roberts on Revolution Radio. Welcome everybody. It's Easter Sunday here in America and most of Europe still. Other parts of the country, it is Monday morning already. But I have a very special guest on today. I have with me Canadian Kevin Annette. Kevin's sites are HiddenNoLonger.com, CovenantedCommunity.org, ITCCS Central, oops, I'm sorry, that's the wrong one, ITCCS.org, and KevinAnnetteInternational.blogspot.fr. Welcome to the show, Kevin.
Thanks, Stephen. Thanks for having me.
Yes, Kevin is currently over in Europe right now. He's been back and forth to Rome and the international court there. First, maybe I thought we might get a little bit, introduce Kevin a little bit. Is that okay first?
Absolutely, sure.
What made you the way you are today, Kevin?
Well, I mean, it started, for people that don't know my story, it started over 20 years ago. I was a Protestant clergyman on the west coast of Canada. And in the course of my duties, I discovered that tens of thousands of children had actually died in the Indian boarding schools run by my former employer, the United Church of Canada, also in the Catholic and Anglican Indian schools. And one thing leading to another, including getting fired and blacklisted for asking why these children had died, we started a huge movement in Canada, which eventually caused the government to admit some of these things. There was a formal apology in 2008. And since then, just actually last month, the Canadian press came out and the government acknowledged that various local governments have records showing that, in fact, tens of thousands of children died in these schools, including from, you know, being deliberately killed and starved to death and other things like that. So, you know, it was a very long campaign, but eventually did force this truth to the surface. And in the last 4 years, I've extended this work, and I'm now working in all over the world with survivors of these kinds of crimes, especially in Catholic churches, where people who may or may not know, there's a standing policy called crimen solicitanus, that when children are harmed, when they're raped or violated by a priest, the priest is under a papal order to cover that up and not tell the police. And if they do tell, they'll be excommunicated. And even the present pope, who is posing himself as a reformer, in fact has affirmed that policy, saying, yes, child rape will not be reported in the Catholic Church. So, you know, this shows it's a huge, enormous crime. And for me, the reason, you know, I've been doing this is over the years is for the children, not only those who have died, but those who are going to be harmed. You know, nowadays, if we don't take a stand and stop this, you know, these crimes occurring under the auspices of religion and state-sponsored institutions.
Yes, yes. sorry about that. What made you decide? Is it just your nature? Did you know before you got thrown out of the clergy that it was going to happen? Or,
well, you know, I don't think I did anything anyone of conscience wouldn't do, because if you're working and you discover that your institution you're in is responsible for all these crimes, first of all, if you don't do something, you're an accessory to that crime under the law. So we all have an obligation legally and morally to not look away. For me, I'm often asked that question, and what I realized was in the year after I was fired from the church, the church went after my own family. My wife at the time was approached and told in no uncertain terms by the church that I wouldn't be working anymore, and therefore she wanted to leave me that help her with her divorce. In the course of that, I lost custody and daily contact with my two daughters. And when I began to personally experience that pain of what it was like to have your family ripped apart, by these churches, then yeah, I realized that it was something you couldn't turn away from because of all the enormous suffering still being caused, you know, by these unaccountable institutions of church and state. So I think, you know, I had to taste some of that myself in my own life. But also it was a matter of meeting more and more survivors and eyewitnesses to these crimes. You know, when you meet Aboriginal people, especially all over North America, who have seen their friends killed, who have been sterilized, you know, at institutions, who have been subjected to horrible experiments and these things that destroyed their life, and yet they still have the courage to stand up and talk about this stuff. I mean, that gives you the ability to go on, even in the face of, you know, enormous odds and attacks that I and other people have faced over the years to bring this stuff out. So I think it's realizing that, you know, we have the truth on our side, and you have to stand on that truth. Otherwise, these crimes continue. So, I mean, I think it was a combination of all of those factors for me.
Yeah, that sounds very, very eerily similar to another Canadian Kevin I just had on like 3 weeks back, Kevin Gillanly. He was fighting the government, and they got to his wife and seduced her into leaving him and taking the kids.
Yeah, it's kind of standard operation when you deal with whistleblowers. You go after their family and friends. You isolate them, you know, and discredit them. Usually they say you're crazy or you're just making stuff up. I mean, all of those things have been thrown at me. Of course, if you're in the world I work in, Aboriginal people have definitely died as a result of working with this stuff, bringing it out. We've had 6 people on our network just on the west coast of Canada alone who have died after speaking about these things publicly, including William Coombs, who actually was a young boy in a residential school in British Columbia. He saw Queen Elizabeth and Prince Philip apprehend 10 children out of that school, and these kids were never seen again. He spoke about that, and he died very soon after that in a hospital in Vancouver, under really questionable circumstances. So, I mean, that kind of thing happens all the time when you're Aboriginal, and you can literally go missing, and people don't really care. They don't ask questions. So, I mean, that's part of the cost that people pay as well.
Yes, it is. Yeah, let's go ahead and get into the reason why you're over there, going to Rome and the International Tribunal Court.
Definitely. Well, you know, I'll give people a little bit of background. If you go to our ITCCS.org site, that's the International Tribunal in the Crimes of Church and State. It was set up in 2010 in Dublin, consisting largely of groups in, you know, a number of different countries who were all survivors of these crimes by the Catholic Church. And so what we did last year is we actually convened a common law court based in Brussels. And this is something that people have the right to do. If your own courts and governments are colluding in crimes, citizens have the right to form what are called tribunals of conscience. And they can adjudicate these matters. That's exactly what we did. We put out all the evidence of genocide in Canada. We named as primary defendants the former Pope Benedict, Joseph Ratzinger, Queen of England, Queen Elizabeth, Prime Minister of Canada, Stephen Harper, and there was several dozen other officials of church and state who we accused of crimes against humanity and of concealing those crimes. None of those defendants ever responded, which was very significant because, you know, in a court of law, when you don't respond to those kinds of charges, you're not contesting them. And they, in fact, didn't. After 2.5 months of exhaustive, you know, presentation of evidence, including documents, first-hand witnesses who saw these crimes, and so on, the verdict, there were 58 jurors, and they brought in a verdict of guilty and a sentence of 25 years in prison for these crimes of genocide. As a result of that, on February 25th, 2013, the verdict came in. 2 weeks before that, Joseph Ratzinger stepped down as Pope. And we do know it was a result of them knowing that this verdict was coming down and that courts have the right to enforce that verdict with arrest warrants. And proof of that is another person named in our indictment was the Vatican Secretary of State, Tarcisio Bertone. He also stepped down a few months after that. And the reason they brought in the present pope was basically to do a big you know, spin doctoring operation to make it look like the church was addressing these things when they're not, really. And Ratzinger went into supposed retirement, although there's a real question whether or not he is still the kingmaker and still wielding power at the Vatican. A number of the people we worked with in Rome, you know, believe that in fact this Pope Francis is just kind of a figurehead right now. Although he himself is now under charges in a second trial that started in Brussels, and that kind of leads up to what I'm doing here now. The 2 weeks ago in Brussels, a second court case, common law court case, was convened about global child trafficking, and it names Pope Francis, Jorge Bergoglio, as one of the chief defendants in a case showing that when he was a priest and a bishop in Argentina, he actually organized the trafficking of children of political prisoners who were in the jails of the military junta there in Argentina. And, you know, there's eyewitnesses to sitting in on meetings where he organized this. And so, yeah, he himself is now under a trial for these things. Again, he's never responded to the summonses. Other defendants include the present head of the Jesuits, Adolfo Pichon, and the Archbishop of Canterbury in England, Justin Welby, all of whom have actually been named recently by again, eyewitnesses in the church and other places have been involved in these crimes. So we're, you know, involved in the midst of the second trial. And today, in fact, at a ceremony in Maastricht, which is here in Holland, there was an order issued basically saying that under international law, the Catholic Church is disestablished because it's a criminal body. And that's up at our site, itccs.org. So I think people need to understand that these are lawful verdicts. These are not just symbolic statements. These courts anywhere in the world have the power to issue arrest warrants based on these verdicts. So it's quite a historic thing because it's never been done before against, especially the Roman Catholic Church.
Yeah, but my big question is, will Italy and Vatican City honor that warrant if it's issued, though, Kevin?
No, they won't. But it doesn't really matter because it still has binding authority. That's why Joseph Ratzinger is hiding in the Vatican now. He knows he can be arrested. In fact, the Spanish government has said, and this was interesting, 5 days before he resigned, there was a diplomatic note received by the Vatican's Secretary of State's office from the Spanish government, and that diplomatic note said they were considering issuing an arrest warrant against Ratzinger if he came into Spain. Because, you know, he had signed letters to bishops ordering them to cover up child abuse. He himself has been named as actually a participant in, if you can believe this, and it's hard to believe at first, you know, for people who hear this for the first time, but eyewitnesses have seen him at various cult ceremonies in Europe, child sacrificial cult ceremonies that have been documented. And these were two survivors of these rituals. The evidence about this man is overwhelming, and they know that he can be definitely arrested and tried in other courts as well. So, I think, you know, even though you may not personally be able to physically detain these people at the moment, the guilty always know their crimes, and they hide out. They show by their actions that, you know, they are guilty, and they eventually, as happened in Canada, it took many years, but eventually the truth forced out these crimes. You know, the same thing will be happening in Europe here. It just takes a bit longer because, you know, these are old, it's the oldest corporation on the planet, and but because of that, it's got tons of evidence, you know, showing exactly what they're talking about.
Yes, I know many of the courts around the world. Many of the countries' highest courts are corrupt. But do you see any corruption in the ITCCS?
Well, the tribunal, the ITCCS, was set up by citizens. It's not allied with any government or any major funding organization or anything. It's totally separate, and it's a community-driven movement. It's a way really to try to spark citizens to take action for themselves in their own communities. For example, we're setting up common law courts in a number of different countries, especially in the United States, where there's been a really tremendous response. And people are convening these courts around other issues, not just child abuse. There's a group in New York that are establishing a common law court investigation into chemtrails, into aerial chemical spraying. And there's a group of farmers in South Dakota that are forming a court into fraudulent mortgages, whereby they're losing their, with the collusion of corrupt judges, they're losing their farms and their homes to these mortgage companies through fraud and other means. So, you know, this is an issue. These issues can be acted on by citizens. And in fact, we've written a common law training manual that talks about this, and it's published on our site, itccs.org, that people can read to show you the background. But the reason we had to convene these courts is because of the corruption of the existing legal system. And, you know, I mean, for example, in New Jersey, where I just got contacted last month by a group of mothers who are trying to get justice by, you know, exposing the fact that their children are being openly trafficked through the government system. They children are being targeted for seizure, and they're then taken out of their families on very flimsy grounds, and then they're trafficked for a lot of money to family, other families, foster homes, orphanages, and those kinds of things. So it's a big child trafficking network through the existing government so-called child protection system. So these are the issues that people are bringing to us, and you know, the really measure of how effective it is the number of people who get involved in this and make it real.
Oh yes, I've been covering a lot of those child trafficking cases here in America the last 4 months, probably maybe even five. A lot of women out there that are really, really sad and really angry at the family courts and the CPS, and they take it out on me and out on my shows. So
yeah,
I know the feeling.
Well, it's an enormous problem. One of the groups we work with in Kitchener, Ontario, up in Canada, they found that the so-called child protection system there, they make $100,000. They're a private company posing as a government agency. They make $100,000 for every child they put into foster homes. And so, you know, it's like private prisons, for-profit prisons. It's a for-profit industry that has a vested interest in breaking up families and grabbing children on for no real reason. You know, so this is part of the reason these things go on.
Yes, they do. I'm not sure if the, well, I know here in America, it seems like the CPS office gets anywhere between $5,000 and $8,000 a month per child that's in foster care. So there really is no incentive to get the child back to their parents or parent, whatever the case is.
Right.
In your research, what kind of history does the church and governments have in child trafficking or ritualistic murders?
Well, it's very deep and it's very old. We found in the course of this latest case we're doing, and the reason I'm in Europe is we've had a lot of people coming forward now who have intimate knowledge of this. We found that there's reference to a thing called the Ninth Circle, and that refers to the Nine Circles of Hell in Dante's Inferno. The Ninth Circle is a child sacrifice cult, and it operates in all over the world with very senior people. There's a woman, Toos Nienhuis, right here in Holland, and I've worked and interviewed her a number of times. Her interview, if you go to itccs.org back on May 8th of last year, 2013, you'll see the interview with her, several hours, where she's describing as a child in Holland being taken to a number of castles where senior Catholic cardinals like Cardinal Elferink of Holland, Joseph Ratzinger, who former Pope Benedict, who she saw in a number of these things, Louis Mountbatten, Lord Mountbatten from England, Prince Bernhard from Belgium, who founded the Bilderberger Group. These people were all present at these things where children were raped, tortured, They were hunted like animals through the woods and eventually killed ritualistically. Their blood was drunk, according to tourists and other people. I mean, these are satanic rituals that go back centuries. Also, the prosecutor for the common law court case that's presently operating in Brussels, into these crimes, he has been given documents from church insiders, Vatican documents from the Jesuit archives, which actually make reference to the Ninth Circle and referring to these practices going on at least several hundred years ago. It's also claimed that popes are expected to take part in these rituals. There's a term they use called the magisterial privilege, where these popes are expected to take part in these ritual killing of children in order to, what they consider, to acquire the spiritual power from the suffering of the innocent. These are very old practices. It's not just starting recently. And, of course, the child trafficking is massive within the Catholic Church. It's Catholic orphanages every year. That's just one aspect of this. But when you have a law in place like Crimen Solicitanus that says to priests, you can not only are expected to cover up child rape, but if you're a child rapist, you can operate freely and will be protected in the Catholic Church. That's a green light to every sick child rapist on the planet to get ordained as a Catholic priest. They'll know they'll be protected by their local bishop. That kind of thing naturally isn't going to cause this kind of epidemic. So this is what we're uncovering in the course of the case. And again, these are documents. These are eyewitnesses. This isn't just, the latest conspiracy theory. This is sent in on solid evidence.
Yes, yes. The the little cover up there thing. The Cardinals being obliged to cover it up. It's basically a lot like police giving the power to beat people up and maim and kill them if they have to get them to submit.
Right. Well, those things are kind of unofficial, kind of understood practices that we'll look the end of the way. But the amazing thing about Crimen Solicitanus is it's a policy. It's a law right on the books. It's in canon law going back to the year 1929. And you can read about it. If you go to our site, hiddennolonger.com, in Appendix 9, we've reprinted this. It was a law leaked 10 years ago to the London Observer newspaper from Latin, from the secret archives of the Vatican. Again, hiddennolonger.com, Appendix 9, you can read it. And it says, that this it's an order right from the Pope's office, saying you'll be excommunicated. And now, actually, the present Pope Francis has extended that to saying you can be imprisoned in a Vatican prison if you report child rape. So, that's like, imagine any other organization saying to their employees, you're expected to protect each other when you rape children, and you'll be fired if you don't. That would be considered a rogue criminal organization, and its officers would be arrested. And yet the Catholic Church has all this political and financial power, so they get to get away with it. They even get President Obama to come and sit down and have tea with the Pope and make it seem like it's some kind of legitimate body, when under international law, the Vatican is a criminal organization by doing that. So is every Catholic priest in the world. They're involved in a criminal conspiracy in trafficking children. So that's why we say, it's time to disestablish that body. And in these rulings from the International Court, common law court, it says, look, the tax exemptions of these churches have got to be canceled. The property and wealth can be seized. These child rapist priests can be subject to citizen arrests, and the top officers should be in jail. This is what needs to happen if these crimes are going to stop.
Yes, it is. Yes. Is there any way to compel the current pope to give up the previous pope who's seeking asylum there?
Any government in the world could do that. They just issue an extradition order to the Vatican, because don't forget, they pose as a government, but under international law, the Vatican City is not actually a government. The Italian government is obligated by a thing called the Lateran Treaty to defend the Vatican. But again, this was a treaty signed by Mussolini. You see, the fascist dictator Mussolini created the present Vatican in 1929. 60 years prior to that, it was actually disestablished by Garibaldi, in the year 1870, he disestablished the Vatican. Mussolini reestablished it, created the Vatican Bank, gave it the protection of the government. But don't forget, Mussolini was overthrown in 1945, and at that point, the Lateran Treaty should have been canceled. But the Western powers, especially the United States, reestablished that Lateran Treaty, you know, bringing political and legal protection around the Vatican. But it is not a government, and it's at any point, people can go in there and arrest those officials for these crimes. So it's not like it couldn't happen. It's just that, you know, when you've got billions of dollars at your disposal, you can buy justice, you can buy protection, and that's what we're dealing with when it comes to the Catholic Church.
Yes, it is. Yes, I remember the early 70s movie. It was The Godfather, where the syndicate head Michael Corleone went to the Vatican City and spoke with a high cardinal or something like that, and it was more or less he paid a fine or a fee and got absolved of all of his crimes and all of his sins, and that's what really made me question the Catholic Church way back then. I was still a teenager, but it made me question things.
Well, as it should. I mean, the whole idea that you can kind of pay God. I mean, I often say to people, "Well, does God deal in cash or credit here?" Because they believe that you pay the church, and that somehow they have the power to arrange things in heaven to get people out of this fictitious thing called purgatory. Now, the reason the Reformation happened is that Pope Leo, back in the early 1500s, was strapped for a lot of cash because they had gone into major debt to this Dutch banking house called the Fuggers for building the St. Peter's Cathedral. So they said, how are we going to get a lot of money? I know. We'll say everybody's soul, of all the people who have ever died, all their souls are in purgatory, and you've got to pay to get them out. And so they went around and they collected all this money, as they still do, from the so-called faithful, and brainwashed everyone to think that you've got to pay to get your souls of your relatives out of hell. Well, you know, like Martin Luther said, he wrote a letter to the Pope, and he said, well, if you believe you can, the Pope can get souls out of hell by praying, why don't you do it for free? Why do you have to charge for it? I mean, Jesus didn't charge to get into the Sermon on the Mount. Why would you charge? Anyone with a brain and anyone who knows anything about Scripture knows that that's a complete fallacy. It's a man-made institution as it is today. I mean, I remember the last time I was in Rome, right at the front door of the Vatican Museum, it says, Papal Blessings, 100 euros. Like, to me, the obscenity of that whole thing is to equate the way of heaven with the way of a bank on earth. And it just, it really has nothing to do with Jesus Christ and the Scriptures. Everything to do with a money-making institution. So I think these things are necessary to wake people up and to say to Catholics, stop paying this criminal body. You don't need it to have a relationship with God. And as a matter of fact, you especially don't need it since they're trafficking your children, you know.
Oh, yes, absolutely. I also questioned that when I was a boy, too. Some of these scandals were of the late 70s and early 80s were coming out when I was an older teen. And it made me leave the Catholic Church. I was forced to go to a Catholic church from the age of 8 until 18. But then after 18, I graduated high school and went elsewhere. So, I think
well, that's the thing. You know, I always, when you watch, often when you go and head out of this information, people go into the Catholic churches and you see these little kids going in there. I mean, don't the parents realize it's not just Aboriginal children who are getting harmed and killed by these churches? It's Catholic children themselves that are being targeted, and they are under obligation to cover it up. I mean, it's a dangerous place to take a child into for that reason. You know, to say nothing of your collusion in a crime by putting money in that collection plate. So we have, again, under international law, when any organization is committing these crimes, you're obligated not to fund them. You know, and so this is, we're standing on solid legal ground when we're saying this to people. But, you know, it's just a matter of common sense and whether or not you care about your own child.
Yes, people here in America, especially the American churches of all denominations, they seem to be faltering. For every one church that pops up, I think seven drop off.
Yeah.
I think people are maybe catching on to the collusion between government and church.
They're definitely, you're right, Steve. People are waking up. And here's a perfect example. In our research for this present case and the child trafficking, we discovered that from the Catholic Church's own records and from the American government records, the Catholic Church in America alone brings in over $170 billion every year. This was records from 2013, so just last year. $170 billion. Is collected in revenue from the Catholic Church. They shell out only 1.8% of that into charitable works. Less than 2% goes into charity. Now, people always say, well, look at all the good works they do. No, 98% of their income does not go into charity. So where does it go? It goes into Rome. It goes into the Vatican Bank. It's used to launder money for the mafia. It goes into major Vatican investments into the arms industry, into Monsanto and GMOs. Into big pharma. Every corrupt, corporation on the planet you can name has Vatican money invested in it. 90% of the money the Catholics are contributing to the church is going into these multinational corporations that are destroying our world and creating weapons and all these other things. Another example, the biggest small arms manufacturer in the world is called Beretta Limited, based in Italy, 100% owned by the Vatican. You know, it's like, you pull back the mask and you see what it is. We've even found that the child porn industry online has Vatican investment in it. I mean, it doesn't stop. It's the most horrendous institution on the planet.
Wow, and that's
again,
amazing.
98% of the funds are going into that, not into charitable work. So it's people definitely have got to wake up to that fact.
Yeah, that's amazing. I hadn't heard that until a week or so ago when Rick said something about it.
Yeah.
It's just, I guess a main question is, are you actually just trying to, there's some dissent out there against you that you're just trying to kill the Catholic Church?
Well, not really. I mean, my first campaign against this wasn't aimed at the Catholic Church at all. If people look at the records, back in 1995, after I got fired, my whole campaign was to looking at the evidence I was being given about the crimes in the United Church of Canada, the Protestant Church. I started there, and it expanded out. I found that, no, it was the Catholics who ran two-thirds of these Indian schools. It was the Jesuits who set up the Indian schools in America and Canada, and the Protestant churches copied them. So, I mean, the web began to expand to include the Catholic Church. They are the biggest crook on the block, if you look at any of these things. So, you know, it's kind of like dealing with the mafia. Are you against Italians? No. But a lot of the mob is run by Italians, so you can't help but look at that fact. Most of these crimes in crimes against humanity, a lot of them can be traced back to Rome historically and presently, you know, all of the evidence we're talking about. So if we're out to, you can say, yes, we're out to disestablish the Catholic Church, but we're also out to disestablish the Anglican Church and the Church of England, which was another major organizer of these crimes of genocide against, you know, indigenous people and all over the world. The United Church, if you look at our first court case, you'll see the three major defendants are the Church of Rome, the Church of England, and the United Church of Canada. So it involves other churches as well. It isn't just the Catholics. But in terms of criticism, too, I mean, I am all for an open debate about this stuff, and anybody who wants to criticize it, that's great. But let's base the criticism on real evidence, not, you know, a lot of my critics just kind of name call and put out allegations that they themselves don't even back up. I'd say to people, if you want to address the evidence, that's fine, but let's not engage on the level of innuendo and hearsay, which is a lot of what the criticism is. It's not based on a lot of hard facts. And let's just look at the evidence that we brought out. I think it's interesting, too, that the churches and governments have never sued me. You know, they've never countered with evidence of their own. They've just stayed silent or just thrown mud in my direction.
Sued for
libel,
you mean?
That's the action of a guilty institution, not those with counter evidence. to put forward.
Sued for libel? Is that what you mean?
Yeah, I've never been sued for libel.
Or slander, whichever it happens to be.
No, that's right. And that's the first thing they'd do if they had evidence against me.
Yeah, yeah, you would think. Yeah, that's what a lot of dissenters, a lot of detractors will do if they can't really combat the the message. They'll just hurl insults at the messenger.
Well, that's what they teach you in law school.
Yeah,
I remember when I.
It is.
You don't have the evidence, you attack the witness, right?
It is, yes. And they teach us. They taught us that in journalism school too. So
right, there you go.
Yeah, you see that on a nightly basis on those fake news networks, the 24/7, 365 networks.
Right.
Where can we go from here, Kevin?
Well, I mean, I'm just you know, what I often say to people is I'm not really good at blowing my own horn or anything, but I think it's important for people to follow my story over 20 years because it shows you the impact even one person can have. If you stand on the truth, if you don't give up, if you keep putting this out there, the truth has an amazing power on its own. You know, it's easy to get discouraged when you look at the totality of these crimes, and yet if you stay persistent, it makes up for your lack of size by, you know, the power of the truth. And guilty parties know that the truth comes out eventually, and so they do everything possible to scare people into submission, to do everything, you know, using fear and intimidation. But you know, I say to people, you can learn from my experience to show how our best weapon against these people is going public, staying public, and standing on your evidence all the time, and it can move mountains literally. So I'd say, you know, just take inspiration from what's happening now in my work, but also more and more people are coming forward now. The tribunal I work with now has groups in 21 countries around the world, and they're having real impact. I mean, in Canada alone now, the number of people come forward, and in the United States, we have several dozen common law groups operating that are, you know, literally walking into Crown-based courts in Canada, for example, and saying, we don't recognize your jurisdiction. The Crown is a convicted criminal institution. You have to stand down from your oath of office, and we need real courts that can operate according to the law and not these private commercial courts, which are unaccountable, just like churches themselves. So people are beginning to run with this, and I'm really inspired. I mean, I don't have enough hours in the day to respond to all of these things that are happening now as a result of our work.
Yeah. You mentioned a couple of key phrases, and something maybe we can get into a little bit if you would like. Your knowledge of common law or sovereignty, natural law, God's law, as they call it.
Yeah.
Why don't you think governments and the Crown and maybe the Vatican respect our sovereignty?
Well, because they're arbitrary bodies. They, you know, under natural law and common law, it says authority only has validity if it rests on the consent of the people who are part of that government or church or whatever. It's got to be informed consent, and it can't be coerced. And authorities can arise on that basis. But when you look at, you know, courts, government, churches, they're corporate bodies. They were never elected. They are not accountable. And the best example is this child trafficking and this history of crime, where not a single person in Canada, for example, has ever been brought to trial for the death of over 50,000 of these children in these Indian schools. Those are arbitrary, self-governing bodies. And they're not accountable. On that basis, under natural law, they're illegitimate. They may be a de facto power, but they're not a de jure power. They're not a lawful power under the law of God, or of human beings. And so we say, look, what we're doing is simply reestablishing what should be. Anybody has to be accountable. Judges, traditionally in common law, don't have a lot of authority. They're just they are really advisors to juries, advising them on points of law and procedure. But the jury in the common law tradition of coming out of England had ultimate authority, you know, as the source of the law. And that's what we need to get back to. So, you know, this is kind of generally what we need to be going, because we've tried time and again through the existing courts to get justice. And in Canada, for example, over 10 years ago, when we first brought this evidence into courts, the Canadian courts, the Crown courts, continually said we cannot rule on issues of genocide involving the Crown. And we said, why not? They said, well, we just can't, you know, because they're appointed Crown judges. Time and again, lawyers in Canada tell me, well, we can't raise issues of murder of children because as officers of the court, we can't challenge the Crown. So, I mean, this is the dilemma you're facing, and you can't expect an institution that did the crime to charge itself with anything. We need to do that as citizens, and we have every right to do that under our customary rights as free men and women.
Yes, yes. That's one of the big stories I've heard out there in the last year or so now, that the Queen and some of the so-called royals have been also convicted of some of these crimes that you're talking about, the child ritual sacrifice and the child molestation.
Yeah, well, you know, that's unfortunately, more and more of the evidence is coming out to show these top level officials of church and state are directly implicated. And, you know, again, the proof is the fact that they're not defending themselves, because when anyone has their good name besmirched in any way, saying, well, we suspect you of crime, the natural response is to defend their name in public and to say, no, I deny that. It's not true. Here is evidence that I didn't do it. None of them have ever done that. Now, they're not doing it, they're not responding, not simply because they have a lot of power and they're just snubbing their noses. They're not responding because they're agreeing by their silence that what we're saying is true. That's a simple article of law. And every single one of them have done that. Not once have they challenged what they've said about them, or the evidence, or the eyewitnesses.
Silence is consent in the court.
That's right.
In the court's eyes.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I know that the Crown, the Queen, and some of the royals, they've just been slinging mud at people that are calling them pedophiles and ritualistic murderers. That's all they do is sling mud at them.
Well, and they expect everyone to go along because, after all, you know, they're in charge, aren't they? Well, the point is they're not. And when, well, you know, the citizens are a sleeping giant. Once we awaken, take back their authority, these people will just all fall. And that's, history shows that all the time.
Yes, it does. Yeah. And hopefully that'll be within my lifetime anyways, sure. I'm hoping.
Well, it's happened in America. I mean, like, you know, reading the very inspiring things, that come out of America. I mean, I remember before the American Revolution, there was a common practice in New England for the citizens to get together and nail up the courthouses because these Crown judges were acting fraudulently. It's exactly the same situation today. They had to get rid of these Crown judges before they could bring in justice. And, you know, that's exactly what, there's a group like the National Liberty Alliance in America that does a lot of education around the common law, how to create citizen juries. This is right in the American tradition. That's what gave rise to America. So it's really people reclaiming their own tradition.
Yes. Are you referring to John Darish in upstate New York? Yeah.
Yeah.
I've had him on once. I just sent him an email. I'm going to get him on again here soon.
Good.
Yeah, that's one thing with the common court and the and this. Doesn't somebody have to be off the grid, off the system, and claim their sovereignty back to actually be on one of these juries?
Well, you don't have to be sovereign to be on a jury. Any citizen can be, just volunteering. But it helps to be sovereign. And the reason, here's an example, one of the things people down in Canada is they revoke their so-called birth certificate and their voting registration. Those are the two ways they have people locked in to the system. And another thing, that the birth registration has to be revoked because it's the way that you sign over the authority of your flesh and blood child to the state, to the corporation. And proof of that, we had that recently, one of our groups in Ontario found that there was one case of a mother who Children's Aid grabbed two of her four children. The two they took were the ones who she had registered. They couldn't touch the other two. And that's proof of what we're talking about. You've got to get your children out of the system, deregister them. There's a, and there's, you know, groups online that teach you how to do that. So yeah, get out of the birth registration and the so-called voting system. And, of course, the whole tax system, the income tax system is fraudulent from the get-go. But I would say that's a really necessary step for people to reclaim their personal sovereignty. But again, we're operating on not just the personal level, but as a community, we need to take back our sovereignty. And one of the main ways right now is through these common law courts.
Well, that's the one thing about Americans. I'm not sure if there's something being fed to them in the food, or maybe it's fluoride in the water. They can hear countless times that federal taxes are voluntary. They can hear that this is true and that is true, but still trying to get people to get out of the system is nearly impossible. I think, I don't know whether people love their servitude or not, to tell you the truth.
It's comfortable. They seem to think it's secure, that Big Brother will take care of them if they just obey him. But we're finding all the time people are waking up from that. It's true that chemically with fluoride, I mean, as people probably know, fluoride was a drug used by, you know, perfected by the Nazis, used in the concentration camps to keep people docile. But that and the electromagnetic influences, they are effective only to a certain extent. We find that when people's higher minds are activated, they can break out of that. And, you know, we're living proof of that. I mean, we're not walking around in a dumbed-down state because we've awoken to a higher consciousness that they can't control. That's kind of the spiritual aspect of this. That higher mind, and people have different names for that, you know, God or whatever, but within that awareness, we find that they lose their control over us. And it works really in a chain reaction effect. And I'm seeing that happen more and more. But people have got to get, especially the younger generation, got to get them off there with iPads and the electronic things that really, you know, I saw a show the other day where a neurologist said that if you're plugged into that electronic system for very long, the part of your brain that is empathic, that is intuitive and imaginative,
yeah,
it's shut off because your analytical mind is at work. And literally, they're making people components of the machine through those little systems. So we've got to get the kids off that and back into normal relations with one another, with Mother Earth. You know, I was in the park today, and I saw these kids running around here in Holland just being kids, you know, outdoors. That's what we got to get back to if we're going to really awaken.
Yes, it is.
You know, our people again.
Yes, it is. And television does the same thing too, Kevin. That's why they switched here in America, like about 4 years back, from the analog signal to the digital signal, because they can control the viewer a lot more consistently than what they could with the old analog system.
Right. Well, and also, yeah, it shows, that's a good point, and it shows that television came in America in a huge way between the years 1953 and 55. In that three-year period, it went from 1 in 50 Americans having television to 1 in 2. And that was exactly the time frame for the MKUltra mind control experiments, where they were not only fluoridating the water in a big way, but bringing in the alpha wave.
And the flicker rates.
You know, the television signal creates an alpha wave state in the brain, which is when you're in a semi-sleep state, you're open to suggestion.
Mesmerizing.
That's exactly what TV was designed for and still is. So they keep ramping up the technology all the time, and as they do that, we got to just simply flick it off and, you know, rely on our own God-given abilities and the health that's around us in Mother Earth and in nature all the time.
Oh, yes. I haven't had a TV in 3.5 years. I haven't had a cable bill in 3.5 years. I give a $700 TV to my niece. It was a 38-inch widescreen. I just gave it to her and said, "Have fun."
Yeah.
But Yeah, I think you're right. We've only got about 2.5 to 3 minutes left here. You want to go ahead and finish us out here?
Absolutely. Thanks, Steve. Well, we'll come on again and we'll give you updates all the time, but I just wanted to urge people again to go to our website, itccs.org, hiddennolonger.com, and our covenantedcommunity.org site. I'll be traveling again after Europe all through the states on lecture tours, helping with the common law courts. If people want to reach me, and I'll be happy to come into your community and we can get down and get this work going where people are based, you can write to me. My email is hiddenfromhistory1, like number one, hiddenfromhistory1@gmail.com. And just keep going, people. We're making history, and we're having an effect, so I just want to invite everybody to be part of that.
Yeah, very good. I'm down here in the state of Michigan, so if you ever get down to this area, I can possibly set you up with a live show along with a presentation.
Let's talk about that more offline. We'll do that for sure.
Yes. Okay. Well, I'm going to go ahead and let you go. We've got less than a minute here until I hear the music, and we've got a big old break. And I'll bring another guest up on. So thank you very much.
Well,
and
thanks again, Stephen.
And have a good night over there.
Yep, you too.
That's it.
Bye for now.
All right, goodbye. All right, everyone. I'm going to go ahead and let Kevin go there. And then after the break, bring up my second guest here. So it was a very good interview, whoever just posted that in there a minute ago. Noodles 9000. Thank you. Yes, it is, Bear. It is live. The break is coming up here, and I've got another guest coming on right afterwards. So, everyone stay tuned. That was Kevin Annette from British Columbia, Canada, that was just on. And I've got David Frank coming up next. So we'll be right back.